It is episode 64 of the Book Exchange podcast. Happy New Year and greetings to all of our listeners around the world. I'm coming at you. My name is Jew Joseph Lovell. I am a co-founder and co-host of the Book Exchange podcast, and I'm coming at you, as I do every time, from the Lehigh Valley in the great state of Pennsylvania here in the United States. We got a really fun episode coming up tonight, but before we even talk about it, I'm going to welcome my co-host and co-founder, that's John Lovell. John, go.
Yes, sir. How are you?
I'm good. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Happy New Year to you. Happy New Year to all. Anyone listening in on this great conversation, we are kicking off the year 2024. But in order to do that, I'm stealing your thunder here a little bit. But in order to do that, we're going to take a look back at the year that we just finished. So I'm excited about the discussion we're going to have. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. It's kind of our, it's sort of our wrap party for the year that was, right?
Yeah, yeah. And this is something that, you know, for the two of us has kind of evolved over the years. Like we've had, we've exchanged favorite books of the year lists for quite a while. I don't know. I don't know if it goes back 20 years, but it goes back a while where you and I kind of run down our favorite books of the year. You know, I'm sure in the beginning we just kind of talked about them at some point, and it was a while ago, just for our listeners, we started exchanging lists, like top 10 lists, just for fun, because we enjoyed like reading the ones in the newspapers and then in the, you know, back in the day, and, you know, on online lists, et cetera, top books of the year. We were doing it way before Barack Obama, by the way, just so everybody knows. Although, you know, it's fun to read his lists and stuff. But anyway, we were doing it for a while, you know, and then it's just become part of the whole book exchange between, you know, the humble co-hosts here, John and myself. And then so it just makes sense to kind of, you know, fit it into the podcast. We didn't do it last year because we were having a technical hiatus. But the year before we did, you know, going back many episodes, we had a best books of the year from 2021. And now we're back here again at the beginning of 2024, but it just makes sense, like you were just saying, kind of just take a look back and talk about, you know, the books that were our favorites from the year, and not to keep going, but like, you know, John, you know, like our listeners know and you know, we read a lot of books during the year. You and I read very different books during the year. And so it's fun for us, you know, like we always have this exchange going on, but it's fun for us to kind of keep the other guy in suspense as to what books, like, you know, the 10 books at the end of the year that really stood out from all the books that we read. And then another fun part is just seeing, you know, like how different they are, or if sometimes you have overlap, and we've got a little of everything in this episode. So yeah, this is going to be fun just to review the best books from 2023. So, I don't know what else you got on the subject.
I mean, that pretty well sums it up. I think anyone who's an enthusiast about anything, whether, you know, be it movies, books, music, it's always kind of fun. And, you know, this is what critics do. And, you know, armchair critics like us tend to do the same thing. You kind of look back on the year, you look back at everything that you listened to or watched or may have read, and you just kind of try to discern, you know, those titles that stood out or that have lingered in the mind, you know, throughout the whole year. That's, I think you and I kind of approach it that way. We just kind of think towards the end of the year, you know, what are the titles that really just stuck out in our memory and have lingered in our mind, and maybe would be the ones that we would go to right away if somebody said, you know, recommend a few books that you read over the past year that you think I should take on. You know, you kind of think back and you try to pick the ones that, you know, just sort of raise themselves up to your attention. So that's always fun to do. It's fun to put these lists together. I think it's fun to listen to these types of lists from different, you know, critics or different people, and just kind of see, you know, how different people's tastes are and stuff. So even between you and me, you know, you're definitely gonna notice some differences, like you said. But I mean, we always really enjoy sharing these lists, and hopefully the listeners will enjoy hearing what stood out for us.
Yeah, totally. And hold some of those thoughts, because when I was listening to you speak, you gave me a thought or two. I'm going to going to do a little ad lib here at the beginning when we once we get rolling on this, based on some of the things you were saying. But I'll explain there.
Nice.
And yeah, the only thing I'd say, the only thing I'd add is that yeah, it's like I've been saying, it's fun for us to do, and you know, like John said, you know, we enjoy listening to other people's lists, and sometimes you get, you know, some really great ideas for books to read the following year that show up on your list the next year, you know, all that kind of stuff. But also, like, John and I, if I can speak for us both for just a second, we tend to be like, we know what we're reading all year. We talk about it all year. Anybody who listens to the show knows that we're talking all the time about books that we're into. But somehow there's still a surprise element with the list at the end of the year. I say we like to keep in suspense what books actually made the list. But also we're usually just kind of, I think both of us are sort of, you know, more often than not impressed with the other person's list, you know, what kind of stuck with them and shown through, and almost even like what it shows about them as like a reader, and, you know, the things that they're into and the different corners they'll go into. I know I'll speak for myself right this time. Like, I'm always impressed with John's list. They go into such crazy corners. You know, John reads more nonfiction. And you're going to see this year, there's almost like no stone unturned, you know, on one of John's lists. And then, you know, I'll let him speak later on for what strikes him about my list. So, but yeah, I'm going to do a little bit of an ad lib once we start, John. But let's take it here and follow the format before we get, you know, too long in the tooth here in the episode. If there's nothing else that you want to cover kind of administratively, why don't you tell listeners kind of what you're reading at the moment, and we'll talk about the books we're reading right now, and then we'll get into the thick of the episode.
Yeah, that's fine. I'll put out the usual call for interaction. If there are books that you read this year that you really want to tell us about, or that just stood out to you, or they're the most recommended, or the ones you just remember most vividly from the year, you can send that to us via email, Book Exchange. That's exchange with only an X. BookX and the word change at gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. And
wait a minute, John.
Yep.
Correction, bookexchangetwins@gmail.com.
Yeah, see, screwed that up. Okay, bookexchangetwins@gmail.com. So write that down if you haven't already. Yeah, but to get into what I've been reading lately, I'm kind of, you know, rounding third and heading for home on this. On a book that I'm just enjoying tremendously. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can hear you. Okay. Went out for a second.
Okay. I did get a little bit of an echo, so we'll just, you know, that's par for the course here if you listen to this show.
Right.
And so I'm reading a book that comes from a French philosopher, of all people. I mean, somebody I'd never heard of before. But this was a book that sometimes you just see a book and you just see the title or see what it's about, and you just think to yourself, I need to read that book, and you kind of take a flyer on it. And that's what I've done with this book. This book is, you know, this may elicit some chuckles from some corners, but the book I'm reading right now and hugely enjoying is called A Philosophy of Walking, and it's by a man named Frederick Gros, or Gros, maybe you don't pronounce the S in France, I'm not sure. But as I said, I think he's a philosophy professor. And it's just kind of a meditative look on the act of walking, which is just, you know, for brief background, I mean, walking is something I've been trying to do more of in my life over the last couple of years. And I just, when I read the description of this book on the back of the book, I thought, man, that sounds really interesting. Because what it is sort of a mixture of kind of like, I guess, meditations on the act of walking and different benefits you may receive from it, or different aspects or different ways you can walk. And some of them are personal and some of them are just more philosophical, but it's very readable. And then he'll intersperse those chapters with basically chapters about famous thinkers throughout time and who may have been walkers themselves, people like Friedrich Nietzsche or Rousseau or Henry David Thoreau. You know, all kinds of different Kierkegaard, different thinkers across time who have basically used walking to help them think. And so the whole book is kind of this meditation on as I said before, kind of the benefits of walking, but not really the physical ones. I think the physical benefits of walking are well known, but you know, how walking can be used to kind of enrich your life, either through your thought life or your spiritual life. And he kind of, it's just kind of this broad survey of different aspects of walking, different ways you can think about walking. And that sounds strange. I mean, if I just kind of read slowly through some of the chapter titles, though, to me, this book is really, really intriguing. And, like the chapter titles are like, Walking is Not a Sport is the first chapter. And all the chapters are brief, which I like too. And there's a chapter called Slowness, and there's a chapter called Solitudes, and there's one called Gravity, and there's one called Melancholy Wandering, and there's one called Silences. So it really is, it's a philosophical book, but it's also, it touches on the spiritual, which I really like. And then, as I said, you have other chapters, you know, called The Passion for Escape, Rimbo, The Walker's Waking Dreams, Rousseau, Why I Am Such a Good Walker, Nietzsche, Conquest of the Wilderness, Thoreau, Mystic and Politician, Mahatma Gandhi. So it's kind of, in a way, it's sort of a historical survey as well. But I'm just, as I've been trying to get more into walking in my own life, and as I've noticed how, you know, again, not just the health benefits of it, but the way it sort of clears your mind and kind of gives you focus and energy, particularly in the beginning of the day. If you start your day with a long walk, you kind of go into your day a little bit more energized. And sometimes it's fascinating to see, to just almost observe, take a step outside of yourself and see like where your mind goes when all you're doing is this solitary repetitive activity and you're just living in your mind the whole time. And so that's sort of what the book is about. I find it to be, it's really well written. So that's been a pleasant surprise. Has a ton of just fascinating insights, either from the author himself or from other thinkers who have talked about the ways that walking have helped them. And there's even a chapter on, you know, walking for people who have gone insane, you know, so it's like, it's not all benefits. Sometimes it's like you can get so lost in your own thoughts, you know, you're just wandering around aimlessly. So I don't know if I'm doing a very good job of explaining it, let alone selling it, but I'm really enjoying this book. I think I could see myself coming back to this book, especially as I try to, you know, be consistent as a walker and kind of build my endurance as a walker. It just gives me personally a lot to chew on and to think about, you know, what the benefits of that activity may be beyond the physical. So I guess I'll leave it there, but I'm really enjoying this book. I find it to be quite unique and really engaging. So I don't know what you think, but that's what I've been reading.
Well, I mean, you said at the beginning, this could elicit a few chuckles and I let you have one.
Yeah.
But that's, you know, because this is such a John, I say this all the time on the show, but such a John F. Lovell book. It's such a JFL book. And it is. And I know that it corresponds with your, you know, sort of recent interest with walking. And I do some walking, but not nearly as much as I should and not as much as you, that's for sure. And not as far as you, because I went on a walk with you a couple months ago and it was long.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, I mean, I think you did a fine job of describing the book, you know, like, selling it is another matter, but like, you know, I mean, you know, that's just a matter of taste or whatever, but like, I can totally see how it's the kind of reading you like to do, you know, even if you weren't walking a lot, like, or if like you weren't walking at all and this book was like, you know, sort of inspired you to get into it, you happen to be sort of engaged in the practice, but it's the kind of thing that you like to do in reading in a broad sense, which for me is like, I would describe as kind of like a, you know, like a, I hate to use cliches, but like a deeper dive into a certain aspect of life or, you know, like a thoughtful, you know, examination of things that are fairly common or things that go on in the world today, you know, or have gone on for centuries, you know, or have gone on in our planet for centuries, like the animal world, like you enjoy books that take kind of more ruminative and like thoughtful dives into some of these things. And in this case, you're also happen to be engaged in the process itself. And, you know, and I think, you know, like, I think you've experienced like, you know, benefits in your own life from doing the walking that you're doing. And so this book is kind of fit right into all that, you know, like, and then, but I also like it when, you know, when writers, there are certain kinds of books that, you know, take a deep dive into something like philosophy or religion or, you know, theology or whatever it is. And they do it, you know, sort of like reader be damned almost. And they do it just at the level that they're at, or like the high level of writing or thinking about it. And, you know, you kind of have to struggle your way through reading about it. Like with that book that you read it early in the year, I can't remember exactly. What's the book you read a couple months ago that was like a tremendous struggle? And it was,
there's a book
philosophical.
Called, it was a book called Real Presences.
Yeah. Yeah. When you were talking about that book a couple, you know, episodes ago, and you were talking about how much of a struggle it was, there are books that do deeper dives like that you often enjoy. That one you were kind of struggling with, but you often enjoy. And then there are books that do deeper dives into deeper subjects, but also have the ability, like what I'm getting to is you said that it was also really readable in short chapters. And those kind of books are really impressive to me when like somebody takes, you know, a dive into something like philosophy of X, but mm-hmm. presents it on the level that's like really understandable, readable, consumable, and like really makes it kind of an attractive thing to read. That's impressive to me too. That's all I was trying to say there. So yeah, no, I mean, it's a great choice. It's very you, but it sounds really cool. Like I probably would benefit from reading it myself.
Well, I just to wrap this up, but you know, I just noticed, like, since I've been doing it, I've noticed that there are certain sort of mental and almost spiritual benefits to doing it, and I found that to be really interesting. And then the idea that there was a book that might tap into some of that just appealed to me a lot, and just, you know, I just wanted to kind of explore that for my own interests. But anyway, you know, go take a walk with Frederick Grohl if you are interested in that. But let's move on to what you're reading.
Yeah, okay. I'm engaged in Dickens Fest 22. Oh, yeah. Listeners of this show have heard me say that I have this personal practice or personal commitment that I made around the year 2000, the millennial year, and where I basically read a book by or about Charles Dickens once a year. For the commitment was to the rest of my life, you know, and into the year 2000, I was 30 years old. So we'll see how I do it. I just thought I would kind of go through the Charles Dickens books that are out there and, you know, read one a year and then, and just repeat, you know, rinse and repeat, and maybe intersperse some biographies or some nonfiction works, stuff like that. So that's what I've done. I'm like 22 years in. Dickens had something like, I don't know the exact number, but it was something like 14 or 15 novels, like full novels that he wrote. There's lots of stories and journalism and stuff like that. But the big novels that he's famous for, something like 14 or 15 of them. I've been through them all at least once. And now I'm kind of going back through with a couple of things interspersed. There were some nonfiction books and stuff like that. So I happen to be rereading the book Our Mutual Friend by Charles Dickens. And, you know, I mean, it's a commitment to read a Charles Dickens novel, especially, you know, one of his major ones. This happens to be the last completed novel he wrote. You know, famously, he died while writing the novel, The Mystery of Edwin Drood, which mm-hmm. I've read once, which, you know, you can also buy as a standalone, but it was literally unfinished, kind of ended in the middle of it. The last complete novel he wrote was Our Mutual Friend, which was published in 1865. And it's a 900-page huge novel set in, you know, Victorian England. And I'm on page 300 of 900. And, you know, rather than really go into saying what the plot is, you know, like the Dickens plots are Byzantine, as a lot of people know. But it's got most of the hallmarks, you know. It has a lot to do with money and privilege and classes. And there's this kind of a murder mystery element to it, you know, like at the very beginning of the book. It's all kicked off by this guy who kind of like dredges the Thames River in this like crappy boat, And he's a single father with like an adult daughter who really dotes on him. And he's like dredging the Thames, and he finds this body that washes up, and the identity of that body and the ripple effect of who that person was. And, you know, there's an inheritance, and there's the whole legal battle around who he was and where the money goes and stuff like that is kind of what drives the entire book for 900 pages, you know? So, you know, I'm on page 300 of 900. And, you know, it's a commitment, and it's kind of, and it's a bit, Dickens books are a bit of a slog. And rather than continue on about the plot, I was thinking this year about, you know, why do I kind of do this every year? You know, it was inspired by this walk I took in London in 2000, and it was a Dickens related, it was a Dickens themed nighttime walk where we went all over London and visited places that were made famous by his novels on foot. Just kind of really magical. And I was just starting out, you know, finishing with my creative writing degree in graduate school and had big dreams for creative writing myself. And I thought, well, you know, I'm going to read one of his books and I'm going to do it every year. And there was a teacher I had who kind of enjoyed rereading Dickens books and other classics from the 19th century. So I kind of emulated that. But just to wrap up, you know, so every year I kind of wonder why I'm doing it, because it's like, I get about a third of the way in like I'm now, and I'm dying to read other books and I'm dying to read modern books. And I'm like, why am I really doing this? But, you know, for me, it comes back to, I pick up the book. I only advance like, you know, four or five pages because it's thick. You know, every conversation goes on forever. The language is mellifluous or whatever that word is, Baroque. And, but there's something about the escapism that represents for me, these kind of books have a way of making you just drop whatever you're stressed about and just go into this other weird world that existed a long time ago. And also the richness of Charles Dickens' language. It doesn't matter if it's like a ridiculous conversation between two kind of like comedic madcap characters, or if it's a long dialogue between a husband and wife, or it's like a death scene at a bed. There's this richness and kind of elegance and kind of beauty to the language that he used that doesn't really exist anymore. And for me, I find that like kind of a consolation against all the, you know, the noise of the world, John, if that makes any sense. And I also feel like that kind of language really helps me to shape kind of like my vocabulary. And I'm not trying to sound snobby, but it helps me to expand kind of my grasp of the English language. And it does that in a way that most other books from the 20th century on just don't do for me. So I like getting lost up in that. And that's kind of really what it's all about. I kind of like just ruminate in the chewing sense almost over the language of Charles Dickens novels. So that's why I'm reading him. And that's why I'll keep reading him.
Well, there you have it, folks. That's a comprehensive apology for the existence of Dickens Fest, at least for one of our hosts. But I mean, those are all legitimate reasons. And clearly at the end of the day, I mean, you kind of touch on how it helps you both as a reader and a writer. And clearly at the end of the day, you're still enjoying getting into these books, which is really the bottom line. You know, I mean, it's the bottom line for all reading, really. You know, you're trying to learn, you're trying to engage with topics that you may be interested in, but at the end of the day, you also want to enjoy what you're getting into. So it still has enjoyment for you. That hasn't worn off in, what is it, 22, 23 years. So, you know, keep going forward with it. I say all the better.
Yeah. And the other thing I would say is that, you know, just, I'm somebody who likes to write fiction. We've said it over and over again. I enjoy trying to write novels, and it makes a lot of sense to me if you are somebody who's trying to be a novelist yourself to kind of take an annual refresher from somebody who was the greatest practitioner of the form that ever lived. So that makes sense to me too, you know?
Yeah. If you're a quarterback, you go back and review the film of Tom Brady or Joe Montana. I mean, that's essentially not that far from what you're doing.
Yeah. So anyway, well, like I think we went on long enough about the books that we're reading, and if there's no other delay, why don't we turn to the topic at hand? Do you have any other thing you want to cover?
Nope. Let's go into it.
All right. So we're going to talk about our favorite books from 2023. So what we're going to do here is really quickly, without delaying more, I'm going to go down my list. Now, John and I do these lists slightly differently. So I rank them from 10 in descending order down to number one. And John picks 10 books, but he does not rank them, but he does select the book of the year. So I'm going to read mine. John, I'm just going to maybe mention in a sentence or something what the book is about, you know, just so you know, it's a novel, it's a nonfiction, whatever. But yeah. Really quickly, I'm going to ask you to read yours. And then I said before I was going to ad-lib a little. I just want to talk for like a minute or two about one particular broad subject. And then after that, we're going to take hand-picked selections from our lists and discuss why they kind of stood out to us during the year. So you ready to go?
Yep.
All right. So I should have been generous and asked you to go first, but I just said I was going to go first, so I'll go first.
Go for it.
So my top 10 books of the year are as follows. Number 10, Dune Messiah by Frank Herbert from the year 1969. John, you might not say the year. It doesn't matter. It's the second book in the Dune saga of science fiction novels, and it's the immediate sequel to the all-world science fiction classic Dune from 1965. Number 9 is a book called The Black Count by Tom Reese. It is a book about the father of the famous novelist Alexandre Dumas, and I may talk about that more in a minute. Number 8 is called The House on Mango Street. By the way, The Black Count's from 2012. Number 8, The House on Mango Street. That's by Sandra Cisneros. It's kind of like a modern classic. It's from the 80s, 1984. It's a kind of a very short and beautiful novel told from the perspective of a young Latina girl who's kind of coming of age in Chicago. You know, I think in like maybe the 50s or the 60s. I might have that wrong. But that's The House on Mango Street. It's kind of a legitimate modern classic. Number 7 for me is The Mountain and the Sea, which is a debut novel by somebody named Ray Naylor. It's an incredibly exciting Michael Crichton-esque science fiction story about the cephalopods, octopi, that are discovered off the coast of Thailand. But it blends in with futuristic elements. It's got like androids in it, and it's got all these crazy science fiction elements. It's a wonderful book. Number 6, My Effin' Life by Geddy Lee. It's the autobiography of the lead singer of Rush.
There you go.
My all-time favorite band. So, yeah. Number 5 is called The Employees. Spoiler alert, John and I are both going to talk about this. Sorry about that, John. It's a kind of a sci-fi speculative novel by somebody from Denmark named Olga Ravn, R-A-V-N, from 2018. I think I stopped saying the year, but that's okay. It's a really weird science fiction novel set in outer space that we might get into a little bit more.
We'll get into it.
Number 4, we talked about it on the show before. It's called The Hunter by Julia Lee. It's a book that John gave me and that he really liked this year. It's about a guy that's sent into the wilds of Tasmania to search for the last surviving member of this particular species wild tiger and all that he encounters doing that. Number 3 is called Gold's Book of Fish by Richard Flanagan. We talked about it in our Australia episode. I couldn't even describe it in one sentence, but if you want to know more about Gold's Book of Fish, I would just recommend that you go back to our Read Around the World series, the episode on Australia where I talk about Richard Flanagan's novel there. Number 2, we talked about last week a little bit with my most memorable female characters. It's a story collection called In the Valley by Ron Rash, came out in 2020. It's one of, I think Ron Rash is one of the great American fiction writers. And this is a collection of, I think, like 8 or 9 new stories and then a novella, which is a sequel to his well-known novel called Serena from 2008. So that's In the Valley. And then my top book of the year was actually 2 books. It was a tie. It's a rare thing, and we've talked about them. 2 books by an Irish writer, a woman named Claire Keegan. And she wrote these 2 small novels that I thought were both gorgeous. One is called Small Things Like These, and the other one is called Foster. So those were my top best books of the year. So, John, how reading your list?
Yeah, that's a great list, man. We've already talked about it. But the interesting thing is, Jude and I, we don't typically have too many overlap choices, like choices in common. We might have one, you know, on the average of maybe one each year.
We're having audio problems.
Oh, are we?
John, yeah, we had a big audio problem there. Like, I if you can hear me now, I don't know what it's going to sound like on the recording, but maybe you just start from the top again. Did you hear me all the way through the list?
I heard you all the way through the list, and then I just started talking.
Okay. Well, I don't know what it's going to sound like. I had a lot of problems hearing you, so let's just take it from the top with your list.
How about I...
And we apologize.
How about I just cut this off, and then we'll just come right back?
Okay. We could do that.
All right.
All right, so we're back. John, I'm just going to launch right into my next one on the list, if you don't mind.
Cool.
Okay, so I have three more, and two of them we talked about a little bit, so I don't have to go on at length about any of them. We'll see how I do. But the one I'm going to bring up right now is one that I've talked about the least on this podcast before, if I've brought it up before. It's called The Black Count, and it's a nonfiction book. You gave it to me.
Yep.
And it's by a man named Tom Reiss, R-E-I-S-S. I never heard of the guy. I've never heard of him since. This book came out in the early 2010s, like around 2012. It won the Pulitzer Prize. It's kind of a biography, but it's not just a biography. And it has to do – it's exactly – you know, it has to do with the titular figure is exactly what the title says, The Black Count. I had never heard of the book. I usually follow, like a nerd, you know, the – Pulitzers and stuff like that. I just hadn't heard of this book ever before, and I didn't even know it existed, let alone the story that's in it. So I could, you know, you could talk at great length about this book, but you don't have to. You know, what's interesting about this for me, it is a biography. The Black Count is a biography written by this white journalist named Tom Reiss. I think he's from like the Boston area, but I can't really remember. And the biography is about the grandfather of the famous novelist from the 18th century, I believe, named Alexandre Dumas. So most of us have heard of Alexandre Dumas. You know, he's like a French-Haitian novelist who's famous for books like The Count of Monte Cristo and blah, 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 Three Musketeers.
Right.
And I think there are a couple other ones, but I can't remember the other ones right now. Stories that everybody knows about, you know, and or has seen some kind of film version. There's tons of film versions on many of his books, you know, and you know, the books have been around forever, you know, since like the 1700s. But when you gave me this book, I was immediately intrigued by it. I can't even remember if I've said this, but the book is a the book's a biography of Alexandre Dumas' father, whose name was, I think, Thomas Alexandre Dumas. This is live TV. I'm just going to look this up. Thomas Alexandre Dumas. He's the father of the Alexandre Dumas that we know. So when you gave me this book, when I first saw it, I thought, oh, well, it's a biography of Alexandre Dumas. It's not. It's about his father, whose story basically inspired Alexandre Dumas. But I thought – I was immediately intrigued, even independently of the fact that it was about his father and not him, because those novels from, like, the 17th century – and I'm just talking personally now – or from the 18th century that came out in the 1700s are, like, a gap in my reading of literature. Like, I don't think I've read many of those books that came out, you know, prior to, say, like 1800, like The Count of Monte Cristo or Robinson Crusoe or, you know, The Three Musketeers or books of that ilk. I just have this big gap, you know, maybe Tristram Shandy or, the books from that whole century was just this huge open gap in my reading. And I've always meant to kind of go back and kind of address some of those things. Also, stuff like Walter Scott, I think, fits in there. Maybe he's the 19th century. I'm not sure. Like Rob Roy and stuff like that. You know, not sure. But it's a big gap in my reading, and so I was really interested in the fact that it was, you know, had something to do with Alexandre Dumas because of that big gap in my reading. But then I found out that it was actually about his father. And basically, it tells this unbelievably incredible and nonfiction, exhaustively researched, detailed story of the father of this famous novelist who had this incredible story of his own by being like born to like a French nobleman and an Haitian slave. No, sorry. Well, the island of Saint Dominique. And he was born of an African woman and a French nobleman of Saint Dominique in the Caribbean. And this man who went on to be the parent of Alexandre Dumas rose. He had this career that was like one of the novels that was eventually written by Alexandre Dumas. He had this incredible, like, rags-to-riches story in which he found his way into the military, rose through all the ranks from, like, a private all the way to, like, a general of the army type of thing, had an incredible acumen for horse riding and sword play. Then he, like, not only did he – and he was, like, this, you know, mix of races – so just absolutely improbable. This was in the French army. Absolutely improbable ascent through the ranks for somebody who's just kind of like a person of a mixed breed. You know, you can imagine like the amount of respect he got in like that century. Mm. Rises through the ranks, has these incredible military exploits. They're all detailed in the book. Gets sent around the world to conduct military maneuvers or military action for the French, like the Swiss Alps. Like all these European countries where he's like in these freezing mountain. This guy's from the Caribbean, you know, freezing mountain passes where he's fighting off half the Italian army with like horses and swords and like cannons, this wildly improbable military career. And then he gets captured and imprisoned and is held in like a tower for like 16 years with no communication with his family, his beloved wife, and Alexandre, his son, and he had other children that he's kind of like trying to get back to. And he escapes from prison, makes his way back to his son and his family, and then has this extraordinary kind of like ladder career. It's like back in the military and kind of a statesman and like an advisor and stuff like that. And the story is absolutely incredible. And the really kind of fascinating thing for me too, again, I always come back to like my writing interests, and you knew that when you gave me the book, because it was essentially about the story. In a way, it was the story of this famous writer Dumas, but it was about what inspired him to become who he became through this incredible story of his father. And the book gets into a lot of their relationship. Now that the father was always gone, and you know, but the boy Alexandre Dumas kind of like worshipped him, and like and not only that, but the man was like 6'5", muscular, handsome, the most handsome man in the world. Yeah. You know, it's just this extraordinary story, and it's all true. And I just thought it was like totally riveting and fascinating. And not only that, but then, and we were talking before about the Frederick Douglass biography. It's the particular work, and we've talked about this before on one episode dedicated entirely to biographies, but we've said this in other places, the biographer's work, like the guy who wrote the Douglass biography, the details, the research, the crafting of the chapters so that you keep the pages turning, and it ends on each one ends on this dramatic moment, and you just can't believe it. It reads like one of Alexandre Dumas's novels, but it's not one of his novels. It's like a true story. And for all those reasons, I thought the book was incredible. I thought it was totally illuminating. I knew nothing about it. And then finally, I'll just say at the end, there was this interesting passage because there's a kind of like a coda to the book where he discusses this controversial chapter in modern French history where they had a debate over whether to erect a statue of Dumas's father. They had a statue of Dumas. They actually had a statue of Dumas's son. And there were these people who took up a battle, like a fight, to kind of erect a statue of the subject of the book, The Black Count, because they felt like he really deserved to have a statue also. And then they won their battle and they got a statue put up, and then they lost the battle and the statue was knocked down. And it was this whole crazy, like, modern coda to the story of The Black Count. All those elements. This book, if you have any interest in, like, literature or history, this book is an amazing kind of, like, amalgam of those two genres. So,
yeah, that book sounds incredible to me. I'm hearing a major echo here, so hopefully that'll fade away. Can you hear me okay?
Yep, I don't hear any of it.
Yeah, that's the kind of book. I mean, I gave it to you, so sometimes we sort of give books that we would be inclined to read ourselves. You know, that's the kind of book that I would be totally, I would totally jump on.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not hard to see where the inspiration for a story like The Count of Monte Cristo might come from when you hear that, just even hearing you describe the life of his father, because it was like right there, elements of it were right there in his own family. And yeah, I mean, that biography, it just sounds fascinating, you know, all the way around. Sounds like a story that not many people know about, that more than deserves to be told. So it's kind of cool when a journalist or a writer will kind of uncover a story like that that hasn't been told and then be recognized for it, like with something like the Pulitzer Prize. And you kind of, you know, it really is incredible that, you know, his father, you know, has the background that he has and was from the Caribbean, et cetera. You know, it's just a sort of side of Dumas that most people wouldn't know anything about, but it's just almost more incredible than anything that he wrote, you know?
Yeah, and I got to say, just as a parting shot, John, this is totally off the line and it's, you know, a little self-indulgent, but I've just been finishing up this novel I'm writing, and I dedicated it to our dad because of it has to do with Thomas Merton, and dad is the one, our dad is the one who turned me on to the work of Thomas Merton, but I found this incredible line from this book, The Black Count, from Alexandre Dumas, where he's like, you know, father, you see, I remember all of the things you taught me in life, and it goes on for like a little while, and it's really moving. And I was like, man, like, I'm going to lift that right out of The Black Count and put it in as like a thing in the front of my book. So I did that. But oh, yeah, I have you to thank for that. And it's really cool. You'll see it someday.
That's cool. That's very cool. Yeah. Well, I'm glad it paid dividends in more than one way. And it was obviously just a really engaging and enjoyable read, which is the name of the game here on the Book Exchange. All right. So, another book that I wanted to kind of highlight from my list that I mentioned earlier, it's called It's called Land of Big Numbers. It was written by a Chinese American woman named Taiping Chen, and it was her debut. It is her debut book of fiction. It's a collection of stories. You know, I mentioned this before that it's, you know, most of these stories are set in sort of modern China, and this is just, you know, it's just a really intriguing mix of, you know, kind of, she has a journalist background, so she did a lot of reporting on, you know, modern China and, you know, what the situation is like there politically, economically, socially. And a lot of that comes through in the book, but she also just happens to be a really impressive writer with an impressive imagination. So a lot of these stories are just kind of slices of life. But they have either, you know, vaguely, like I said before, science fiction-y, or not so much science fiction, something like Kafka, you know, where there's like an absurdist element to some of the stories. Like there's one story, let me just kind of look here because I want to get the titles right. I was really impressed with this book. Both the imagination and the writing just kind of like knocked me over, considering this woman had never... She had worked as a journalist, as I said. She'd written a lot of, obviously, nonfiction and journalistic writing. Never wrote fiction before. I guess, I don't know how long she was working on these stories. But every single one of them was really engaging and kind of fascinating to me. There's a story called Flying Machine. It's all about this sort of farmer who has this kind of inventor streak, I guess. And all he wants to do is join the Communist Party. And his application keeps getting turned down. So he's trying to invent different different contraptions that might, you know, impress the authorities to get to gain him membership. So eventually he kind of constructs, you know, on his own farm in his garage, he kind of builds this like machine that allows you, it's sort of like a hovercraft kind of machine so that you can fly, you know, and then he finally, you know, unveils this to the authorities and they're not really very impressed, you know, but it's just all in the effort of trying to be, you know, be accepted by, you know, the Communist Party. So that's kind of, that gives you some idea of like sort of the absurdity, but some of the kind of like commentary of some of these stories. There's a story that's about two twins that are born. There's like a boy and a girl, and one of them, and it's just kind of this. Uh-oh. What's up?
No, I was reacting to the twins.
Oh, okay. I thought maybe you couldn't hear me. Yeah, problem right there. But,
right.
You know, it's like it takes place in kind of modern China, and the boy twin is just, his entire world is gaming. And so he talks all about gaming and different games that he plays and like the gaming community he's a part of. And the girl twin is like an activist trying to basically involved in protests against the government. She ends up getting thrown into jail and they kind of correspond with each other. And the boy twin is just sitting on a couch, like kind of talking about his twin sister. He's like, oh yeah, you know, they beat the shit out of her today in the jail or whatever, but hopefully she's going to be okay. You know, it's just, these two twins had a very different, took a very different path through modern China. And I just thought it was, and that's the opening story. It's called Lulu. And it really just, that made an impression on me right out of the gate. There's a story called Hotline Girl, which is about a woman in China who works basically at a software help desk. And she's like answering all these different chat lines, you know, like, and they're all asking different questions. And some of the questions are like, how do I do X, Y, Z? And some of them are like, you know, why can't the government, you know, pay me a subsidy so I can, you know, pay my water bill, you know? And she's just fielding all these pop-up, you know, questions that are coming up on her console. Really interesting. And then I have to mention I love this book. I think it's a really imaginative and kind of fascinating look at modern China and people who grew up there, even if they emigrated or moved away from there, how the kind of the tendrils of living in that society have followed them. Because there's definitely one story where there's a Chinese woman who gets married to an American man and she ends up, she's on a tour of the Grand Canyon. And so it takes place in Arizona, but she's remembering different family members or things that have happened back home. But the last story is what I would call the most Kafka-esque. It's called, sorry for the rustling pages here, if you can hear that, but it's called
live TV here, folks.
Yeah. It's called Gubeko Spirit, which I don't remember what that refers to, but it's basically about a group of people who are in an underground, like a train station, and they're trying to catch a train, and the trains are always on time, but this one doesn't show up on time. And so eventually the train never shows up, but they're not allowed to leave because there's this like insane, you know, rule in the Communist Party or something that you can't leave from the same station that you entered. So they, you know, the people just sort of discuss it and they're like, well, we're not allowed to leave, so we have to stay here basically until the next train comes. And they're down there for like months and like, you know, they're living off like whatever's in the convenience stores and stuff like that. And they're just kind of forgotten. And it's this very sort of surreal setup. But all the stories just, and I don't know enough about China to really even know all the points that are being made, but they all kind of, when you read them together, you get this sense of like, of that this is a society that's just immersed in turmoil, that's kind of changing by the day, that's impacted by the rest of the world, but has its own way of doing things. It's just a fascinating kind of like an imaginative trip in your mind to what it must be like to live there and how in some ways it's still a very oppressive society, that demands so much of the people who live there who are just trying to make a living or get by. That's how I would characterize it. But it's just bursting with imagination. It's the stories are really well written, and it just really left an impression on me. So I think this is the kind of book that you would really be fascinated by, because we love to read about other parts of the world. It's an incredible debut, so it's going to be interesting to see what she comes up with next. But this book kind of knocked me out, so I hope at least I'm selling it to you.
Totally. Yeah, no, it sounds really fascinating. What year did it come out?
I think it's like you said, live TV. I can find out. I think it's only – it's a recent book. I think it's only a couple of years old. 2021.
Okay.
So.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if she comes out with other work and stuff. But, yeah. No, I mean, it's – I love reading books like that too, like, you know, the story collections or like debut novels or something from other parts of the world that we just like in this country, you know, and you can almost plug in, you know, country X and we're going to be ignorant of that country. But like there are some places in the world that we just don't, you know, Americans in particular just don't know the first thing about, you know, what it's like to be part of that society, and like China and, you know, Asian countries and a lot of places are like that for us. But like, you know, so there probably is. It's like you said, when I read a book like that, I think to myself, man, you know, because I read a really strange Chinese novel this year called Strange Beasts of China. And I found it kind of weird and, you know, I couldn't latch onto it very easily, but it was so like, it had some sci-fi elements in it. I forget the name of the writer. It was an ethnic, like a Chinese name is what I'm saying, that I wouldn't be able to remember correctly. But it was just really bizarre and strange, and I couldn't like latch onto it really well. But I think a lot of that has to do with like just how little we know about some of these places that we end up trying to read about, you know. But this collection, it does sound really interesting. It sounds like it has enough elements from like some, you know, like you said, like Kafka, or maybe influenced by, who knows who it was influenced by, like literary wise. You know, but it seems to create some intriguing situations and stuff that's just kind of like interesting enough to kind of keep you immersed in each particular story. Sounds like there's a lot of talent there, but there's probably a lot that you miss, you know, about whatever it's trying to say. But yeah, fascinating choice. Like, and also really impressive that it, like, you know, you read it so early in the year and it stayed there, you know.
Oh,
a lot of the books that I check off, they don't make it, you know, to the end.
Yeah, and I'm gonna before I hand it over to you, I'm gonna sweeten the pot for you, dude. And it's one of the other writers who loved this book was Jennifer Egan, who's a huge
awesome.
And she said it's got a blurb on the back of the book. She says, "Gripping and illuminating, Land of Big Numbers offers intimate glimpses of the seductive power of state control, the Faustian bargaining it requires of its citizens, the landscapes and lives it forces them to discard in exchange for material prosperity." So that's your girl Jenny Egan. So
yeah,
you know, take heed.
You know, yeah, that would sell me too. But fascinating one to bring up, and a good one to bring up, because we, you know, it's just another curveball. This is what you get here with the Book Exchange Podcast.
That's right.
So I'm going to, you know, obviously throw a curveball the other way, although it's for you and me, it goes right over the plate and we're going to knock it out of the park, you know. But I couldn't do this without talking about the book My Effing Life by Geddy Lee.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and this is an overlap too. It didn't make your list. I think it was you do honorable mentions. I think it was on honorable mentions, you know.
Well, I didn't. I read, I actually listened to it on audio, which is a whole other discussion.
Oh, right.
But I didn't. I finished most of it in the early part of this month.
Got it. Okay. Well, anyway, but I know you really like the book too.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is like a niche one, folks. You know, like, and you guys, our listeners, have heard us joke about the rock band Rush. Rush is my favorite rock band. You know, you either love them or you hate them. I understand it. I understand that. And their singer and bass player, Geddy Lee, you really either love or hate. You know, I happen to be a huge admirer of Geddy Lee. But he, you know, so the famous progressive rock band from like the 70s and the 80s, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, 40 million records, et cetera, et cetera. You know, they had a remarkable career with just three men, and they famously, you know, endured for over four decades, went on this triumphant 40th anniversary tour in 2015. Then after that tour, the drummer of the band named Neil Peart announced that he was going to retire. He couldn't do it anymore at the level that he wanted to do it. Widely considered to be like the greatest rock drummer in history, or one of them. And then a couple years later, he was diagnosed with a brain tumor, and he was supposed to live only 18 months, and then he lasted 3.5 years, and he died, and that was the end of the rock band Rush. So Neil Peart died in the year 2000, I mean 2020, forgive me. And then, you know, Geddy Lee did like a couple of projects, and then he settled down, and he decided to write this memoir about, you know, his whole life's journey. So, and it's one of these things, John, where like, you know, you find out that like one of your heroes, and for me, Geddy Lee is an artistic inspiration, not only his music, but also his bass playing, which is absolutely unbelievable, all world, and just his creative drive and energy and the way that he, you know, helped to sustain their career. He was really like a big part of my life artistically and musically, like in terms of the music that I like, for almost my entire life. So you hear that a figure like this is going to settle down and write their memoir, and you just kind of sit there with like your fingers crossed that it's going to be any good, you know?
Right.
And you know, I was kind of concerned about that. I know Geddy Lee is kind of a smart guy, and I was going to read anything from anyone in Rush because I love Rush so much, but I had some trepidation. And then, you know, a couple of months before the book was released, they announced the title of the book, which was My F in Life, E-F-F-I-N. You know, with a apostrophe, which I guess you don't have as much problems with this title as I do, but I was like horrified by that title. I thought, oh my gosh, that is supremely disappointing. You know, mm-hmm. I'm worried about the rest of the book or whatever. And I was just afraid that the book wasn't going to deliver, but I was wrong. You know, the book, My F in Life, is an exhaustive portrait of, or self-portrait of Geddy Lee's like entire life. And he goes into the history of his family. And as anybody who knows who Geddy Lee is, probably would know, any fan of Geddy Lee would know that he is the son of Holocaust surviving Polish Jews from Poland. And so one chapter of his book, he committed to doing exhaustive research and telling the entire story of both of his parents, who met during the Second World War and were imprisoned in separate camps in Europe during the Second World War, and improbably kind of like fell in love and connected with each other under the shadow of the Holocaust, and actually got married in a camp, survived the Holocaust, emigrated to Toronto, and, you know, settled in a suburb and had three children, and one of them was Geddy Lee. And Geddy Lee writes this incredibly moving, exhaustively researched chapter in the book about what happened to his parents, and it's an unbelievable story what they kind of survived and went through. And that chapter alone was, I thought, you know, extraordinary to read. But then on top of that, you have a very intimate, it's a funny, detailed, surprisingly, you know, moving catalog of Geddy Lee's entire career in Rush from start to finish, working with the one guitarist, Alex Lifeson, who was a friend of his from junior high school, and then the drummer, Neil Peart, and both of whom were, you know, considered among the greatest in their instruments, and they formed this trio, this rock trio called Rush, which is one of the most legendary bands in the history of modern music. And I just thought it was an incredibly worthwhile read. It was moving. It was interesting. It was candid. He holds some grudges that I was surprised that he holds. He takes you through the story of Neil Peart's, the disagreements they had, whether to retire from performing as Rush, and then Neil Peart's diagnosis in his last years. And he ends with like a super moving and like poignant and note perfect description of an encounter that he was having with his young grandson. I thought My Effing Life, John, was like a tremendously satisfying autobiography. It's one of my favorite musicians' autobiographies. It's one of the best autobiographies by a musician I've ever read. The only thing I would put it slightly under would be Born to Run by Bruce Springsteen, but it's an amazing book, and I had to bring it up.
Yeah, if I had read it in time, it might have been the fourth book that overlapped from our two lists, because it's really good. And I, as I mentioned, I listened to the audio version, which is him reading it. So you kind of, that's cool if you're a Rush fan, for sure. You know, it's kind of like Geddy Lee just kind of narrating his life story to you, you know, over a sequence of morning walks, at least for me. And that was really cool to hear. But yeah, it's everything he said. It's surprisingly good. It's very moving in parts, both with that chapter about his parents and their experience is unbelievable. And I think anybody who reads it will never forget it. It's just an, he said in interviews, it's a miracle that I'm even here. And that's the truth. That's not exaggeration in any way. It's of course an exhaustive kind of look, you know, look back at the whole career of Rush, and he's very, like Bruce's book, you know, that's a good comparison, because he's very vulnerable and honest about his own life personally and professionally. And then just the other thing that comes out through this book is, and this has been well documented, that one of the reasons Rush was as successful as they were, which, by the way, you mentioned the 40 million records or something. Other than the Beatles and maybe the Rolling Stones, no rock band has ever sold more records than they have. So that's unbelievable. Like, their success is as high as it gets. But one of the reasons they were so successful is that you really get through this book, the friendship that they had between the three members and kind of the equal partnership that they formed is a huge part of the book and of the story of Rush. And I think it's a huge reason why they were as successful as they were. The mutual respect between the three of them, it goes way beyond the music. And yeah, and that portrait of those relationships was also very moving and interesting. So there are many facets to this book. It's not just a rock and roll tell all. It's much, much more than that. And I was really surprised, just like you were. So that's a great pick.
Yeah. It was really, you know, it was really satisfying. And there's something that's really great about, you know, like to go take it back to the beginning, like when you're, one of your heroes puts out a book or something like that, you just want it to be good, and this one really, really is good.
It really is good. I feel like we're getting a little short on time. I know I've got two other books that I want to cover, so I think my next one is going to be quick, and then I'll hand it over to you and maybe cover the next one, but that's okay, because this book I want to talk about, one of the most entertaining books I read this year was a memoir by Werner Herzog, the German filmmaker, called Every Man for Himself and God Against All. You gave it to me. Unfortunately, I started reading it kind of like right after we did the memoir episode, or else it would have been all over that sucker.
Here's your chance.
Well, and it's really, I really can't do it justice by just trying to describe it in like 2 or 3 minutes. But Werner Herzog, first of all, if you've seen any of his movies, you know, he kind of vacillates between like fiction films and original fiction films and like documentaries. The guy has traveled all over the world. He's made movies about just about everything you can think of. He has one of the most unique filmographies that you could possibly imagine. If you've seen any of his movies, you know that he's a unique personality and artist with a curious but, you know, inimitable vision. And the memoir that he wrote is right in line. You know, his life is almost too big for any book. You know, he's just had all kinds of just absolutely crazy experiences. You know, he grew up very in poverty in Germany during the years of World War II. You know, it would be impossible to try to describe
everything that he describes in this book, because he's had just some of the most amazing experiences. He's been all over the world. You know, he'll describe being on the edge of a volcano, looking down, trying to film what's going on inside of an active volcano. You know, he famously had his crew and actors haul a ship over a mountain from one part of the Amazon River to the other when he was filming the film Fitzcarraldo. He's just, you know, he was shot during an interview and continued to do the interview on the streets of Los Angeles. You know, he cooked one of his boots and ate it on camera for a short documentary. He just has this absolutely insane life, and he has this inimitable voice, both as a writer and just as a human being. You know, there's a reason that he's appeared multiple times on The Simpsons just because of his heavy German accent. You know, he has like a famous voice. And this book is just, it's full of just absolutely, I have to use the word, batshit stories, you know, from his life or from the movies he's filmed. But it also, it covers some, you know, elements of his personal life. It covers some of his travels, which are literally every continent all over the world, including Antarctica, where he filmed an entire movie there. He's the only guy to do that, I think, or one of the first people to do that. He's been everywhere. But he also, you know, there are elements where he talks about, you know, actors he's worked with and some of those experiences or his relationship to other directors. He has that entire chapter, Jude, you would love this alone. That's called Unrealized Projects, where he talks about films that he wanted to make or would like to make. And they're all just absolutely insane. You know, you read like one after the other and you just go, God, I would do anything to see that movie. Because, you know, I mean, one of them was like a ballet involving elves on the North Pole. Like it's just like, you know, but he also, you know, like for real though, not like a joke, you know, like, but he also, you know, he was the first filmmaker to be allowed into these newly discovered caves that had an incredible array of like art painted on the walls of animals that go back 30,000, 40,000 years. And he filmed the entire thing in using a 3D camera. That's an amazing film. I mean, the guy has been everywhere and done everything. And his memoir is so entertaining. And then, Jude, you just get to the very end, and it has a list of all the films
on the North Pole. I'm still laughing about the elves.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, this is live, man. I couldn't hold it in.
Oh, that's just one of the projects in that chapter alone. I mean, the book is just – it's hilarious. It's fascinating. And you're just like – the whole time you're reading it, from beginning to end, you're going, there is nobody on earth like this guy. And, you know, God bless him for it. You know, like he is just it's every bit as wacky and weird as you would expect if you've seen any of his movies. But it's just told in this inimitable voice. And, yes, sometimes he's grandiose. He knows kind of his own persona and he kind of leans into it. But you just don't care, you know, because it's a hugely entertaining book. I can't wait until you get to read it, because I know you're going to read it.
Yeah, no, I'm definitely going to read it. It's like that story you told when you were bringing it up in another episode, because I think you're about to read it or something like that. And then you talk about him, a great way to phrase that, by the way, leaning into his own persona. Like that story you told about him saying, you know, like you can pronounce his name, Werner, if you want, but don't even try, you know, because you can't say it.
You can't do it.
Yeah. Stuff like that. But yeah, like, you know, John, you know, it's our show. We talk about our dad. One of our dads, remember our dad had a, you know, great knowledge of the Latin language. And one of our dad's favorite phrases was sui generis, right?
Right.
And sui generis just means you're like totally unique out of, there's like a you know, an army of one. And if there's anybody who that term applies to, that Latin phrase applies to, is Werner Herzog. You know, like there's just like you said, there's just nobody like him on planet Earth, and there never has been, there probably never will be.
No,
you know. And then you know that's it's not something to discuss here, but just like I haven't read the book, but the title alone, you know, every man for himself and God against all. You know, what the hell does that mean?
No, the guy, you know, and plus he's like brilliant and also nuts at the same time. I mean, there's so many things I could tell you, Jude, about this book. Like, at one point he wanted to make a movie about, or maybe he did, I don't know. He's made so many movies, but about the famous serial killer, Ed Gein, or Gain.
Yeah.
And so he seriously proposed that they travel to Plainfield, Wisconsin, because he wanted to dig up the corpse of Ed Gein's mother for the movie. You know, these are kinds of things that he does regularly. And I don't know. I don't think he got permission to do that, but that's the kind of thing that he would do. He's both totally insane and like a world treasure.
You know? Yeah, and it's just like the whole project he did with like thousands of hours of footage of people on the death row in Texas. Oh, you know, man.
He made nine movies about those inmates. I've only seen one, but he was so moved by their stories, he made a series of nine films. I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah. Well, yeah, great choice.
We got to cut it off because you could go on for another couple hours about his life. So.
Yeah, and I can cover my last one quickly. Like, you know, we keep saying that, and we say every time that we keep saying that.
Right.
But I just want to mention again, my number one book, it was a tie between these two small novels. We've talked about them on other episodes. My Claire Keegan, one is called Foster and one's called Small Things Like These. I just wanted to bring them up again because of how impressed I was by both of these books. And I want to say a little bit about why I was so impressed by them, because I mentioned earlier in the show that I read them both in the early part of the year, like March, April. How I got to them, my cousin brought up one of them. But I had already started hearing about it. I think there was just kind of this blitz or whatever, trying to get her over into the United States, because both Foster and Small Things Like These are stories that had appeared in England or Ireland or the UK, not England, Ireland, sort of a few years before. And they were, you know, putting them out in these like small hardcover editions in the United States, trying to get her going in the United States or whatever. Although I think that they have good reason to do that. And so they're both very small books. You know, technically Foster was, I think, originally a short story, because it's only like 80 or 90 pages, and it was put out in this hardback edition. And Small Things Like These is not much larger. It's a novelette. It's like about 120 pages. So one of the things that was really impressing me about both books is the great economy that they have. Claire Keegan has drawn a lot of comparisons to Chekhov. And it's interesting because Chekhov has a lot of short stories that aren't very short, you know,
right.
I have a whole volume of longer Chekhov stories. It's not that he did it all in a small space, but in a way he did it all in a small space because he would focus on small details and say, kind of express things that you couldn't express in any other way than focusing on small details or gestures or moments. Little moments from a life. And Claire Keegan has this way of capturing, well, the novel's called Small Things Like These, you know, the little nuances of life in rural Ireland that frequently hinges on tragic events that are often kind of swept under the carpet and not talked about. And both of these books have elements of those things. So Foster, really quick, is about a 9-year-old girl who is one of the oldest or the oldest of child of these two parents living in rural Ireland who are down on their luck and don't have much money. And it's not really explained why, but for some reason they lend this 9-year-old girl that they have living in their house to the mother, her cousin, who lives in a couple communities over, and she's married with no children, and she gives their daughter, their 9-year-old daughter, to her cousin to take care of for like a summer. And that's basically the whole setup. But what you find out is that the couple that takes them in, the mother's cousin, her and her husband had a son of about the same age who died tragically in a well. And they're trying to get past that And so one of the ways they do that, I guess, is to take this young girl in when her parents are struggling to keep everybody fed in the house. And so she goes and she lives with them for a summer. And that's kind of the whole story. She just forms a bond with this childless couple who had gone through a loss. And by the time you get to the end of the book, she has to return back to her house. And it's incredibly moving, you know, just like the way that it's all written about. And the rural landscape and the small details of the farm community that they live in. And when you get to the end, you can barely hold on to your heart at the end of that story when she has to return back home. And then small things like these is a little more complicated, but it's about life in a community, a rural community in Ireland also, where this man is living with his wife and he has five young daughters and he's fairly poor and he's just like a working man. And we learn that he was the child of a woman out of wedlock who probably would have suffered like a much worse fate, except that the woman who gave birth to him out of wedlock was a Catholic. So she was kind of like excommunicated or whatever, or cast out by the rest of the Catholics in the community. But there was a kindly Protestant elderly woman who took the mother and her small son in, and that son grows up to be this father of five daughters and small things like these. And the story is about him trying to raise his daughters and make do in life without knowing who his father is. Again, it's very moving. It's filled with these small kind of dramatic moments that are really convincing and really kind of heartbreaking. And then he happens to discover that there is, and this is based on, unfortunately, true stories about rural communities in Ireland where there's a laundry in the town that's run by these nuns who take in kind of orphan girls and have basically been like abusing them for years inside of these laundries. And this is something that apparently happened in Ireland, you know, over many decades for a long time, and nobody ever like uncovered the truth or whatever. So that is an element of small things like these as well. That is a darker book than Foster. They're both kind of dark, but it's darker. It's troubling, especially if you're a Roman Catholic or an Irish Catholic. But John, just to wrap up, I found both of these books very moving, but supremely impressive from like a writing standpoint. I didn't think there was an errant word in them. They practically got me to like, you know, well up with tears. Mm-hmm. I thought they were spot on with lovely language about the communities, the landscape, work, farming. You know, Foster is written from the point of view of the 9-year-old girl, and you just kind of – your heart just goes out to her immediately. And all this was done by Claire Foster, just like with the ability that she has to write in an incredibly beautiful and very subtle and very compact way. And I just find that incredibly impressive. So that's why those are the best books I read all year, easily.
Yeah. And you got me to read her. You said Claire Foster at the end there, but you mean Claire Keegan.
Yeah.
And you got me to read her basically because of everything you just mentioned, how impressed you were with those books. And I read both of those short books, and they are remarkable books for all the reasons you mentioned. They're just very, very sensitive. They're beautifully written, and there's not a wasted word. And that's like poetry. You know, that's what poetry is like. When you read a great poem, you're like, man, I wouldn't change a single word of that thing. You know, and it might just be half a page. These are short little novellas, but they pack quite a punch. And she is an obvious talent. And, you know, I was saying to you before, you know, not as part of this podcast, but like how there are some major, major writers that kind of went to bat for her early in her career, such as Hilary Mantel or William Trevor, the great Irish short story writer that you've talked about before. If you know anything about William Trevor, I mean, for him to kind of handpick her as kind of like, in a way, kind of like a rising star of her generation is kind of all you need to know.
Totally. Yeah, absolutely.
And you've read much more William Trevor than I have, but I could see the affinity between reading a Claire Keegan story and reading a Trevor story, because it's just all about kind of the emotional nuances
and what passes between people, both said and unsaid. And yeah, they're amazing books. I agree with you 100%.
Yeah, so that's the end for me. And why don't you cover, you know, your whatever you still have left?
Well, I have one more book I was going to mention. I'll just kind of like briefly touch it because I think it's worth touching upon. It's this book called The Tiger, a true story of, I think it's violence and survival. What was it? Vengeance and Survival by a guy named John Valiant, who is kind of I guess a journalist, like a nature writer. I don't know that much about him. I think he's only written two books, and this was the first one. And then he had another book, Jude. I meant to say this to you a couple times, but I don't think I ever did. And, you know, it's the New York Times, whatever. It's just one list. But one of his second book made their top 10 list for the year, which...
Oh, yeah.
And it's called Fire Country. You might have heard of it. But it sounds very different from The Tiger, but just as intriguing. So, like, having read The Tiger and being blown away by it, I really want to read Fire Country now, which is the book Fire Country has to do with some like a series of fires up in Canada that we've over the last couple of years, we've been hearing stories about these wildfires that burn incessantly up in Canada. And he kind of examines one of these incidents, but then he digs really deeply into, you know, what happened, what caused it, and then the environmental kind of effects of these fires. So it's sort of a book, an environmental book, but it's also a book of like investigative reporting. Supposedly it's riveting. Sounds incredible.
Yeah.
So I'm very interested in that. I think it's safe to say I'm going to get to that at some point in my reading life. But The Tiger, very briefly, is about a region in the farthest reaches of the eastern side of Russia. So basically all the way on the eastern coast of Russia, across the sea from Japan. There's a small province there. And there was a series of attacks. What they call Siberian tigers live there. There's another word called Amur, A-M-U-R, Amur tigers. They're a unique type of tiger that live in that region of the world, so that most tigers you kind of associate with living in jungles, kind of tropical climates. But these tigers live in, like, you know, deep, dark winter, snow, you know, remote areas of like Siberia. And they're bigger and they're among the largest cats on earth. But the people, one of the things you get from this book is this kind of really interesting portrait of life in that far corner of the world, which that alone is really interesting. But the people there have always sort of coexisted with the tigers. And the book goes into some of the indigenous peoples from that region and how much they value the tigers there and how they've, you know, they're woven into their mythology and their culture. And the people and the tigers in this region have always managed to coexist until very recently, when all of a sudden there was a series of basically attacks on hunters and people living there by tigers, which is totally unheard of. And so the book kind of investigates, why did this happen? And there was a team of scientists that were dispatched to kind of investigate these incidents, but also hunt and kill this one particular tiger that kills two or three people in this very small community. And Jude, one of the things this book does, it has a forensic quality to it too, but it describes the last days of the life of these two hunters based on just sort of forensic evidence that was found on the scene. And this tiger, it didn't just kill these men. It absolutely obliterated these guys. I mean, the descriptions of what happened to these guys, I couldn't even if I could find it, I wouldn't read it. It's absolutely, it's unreal. I'll just say this, and this is, you know, I apologize to readers who maybe don't have, are squeamish, but one of the two hunters, what was found of this hunter could fit the guy. He describes it very dispassionately, but he says dispassionately, he says one of these, what was found could fit into the pocket of your shirt, like a flannel shirt. I mean, he was completely obliterated by this tiger.
And that behavior was totally unheard of. Nobody knew why. So this book kind of investigates these very unusual killings and why one of the tigers may have just basically turned on the human residents there and literally started to hunt them. And along the way, you learn so much about these tigers and, you know, their environment. And also it gives you sort of a fascinating look at this part of Russia and how it kind of relates to the rest of Russia. And it's kind of like this outpost that has its own rules. And because it's up against the border of China, there's a whole black market trade between these parts of Russia and China, because tiger parts, like literal tiger parts, are very much in demand in China for all kinds of medicinal and your stranger reasons. It just immerses you in this completely alien world, but it also kind of is a book about, you know, men and tigers trying to figure each other out. It was totally riveting, you know, from page one to the end, and kind of like, in a way, in some parts, it was like, you can't turn away from the train, from the car wreck, you know, like you couldn't stop reading about it because it was so awful, you know?
Right.
But it's much more than just, you know, kind of a tale of bloodthirsty animals. It's about Russia. It's about that part of the world. And it also is very much becomes like about preservation and how we can help, because these tigers are very much endangered. So it was a fascinating mix. Absolutely love this book. You know, even if you wouldn't read something like this, I can't imagine picking up this book and starting to read it and not wanting to know what happens next. It's just brilliantly written. So I loved it, and I had to make sure that I mentioned it on this show.
Yeah, you know, if it wasn't for that darn guy that wrote the Frederick Douglass book, you know, what's his name? The guy who wrote that book got robbed, you know?
Yeah.
Because he would have been number one on your chart for sure.
Oh, it's just, I was just totally gripped by it. So.
Yeah. And I knew when you were reading it, cause you were just talking about it like a, you know, like a loose streak, but like it, you know, the, there are books that are like that, you know, you're reading them and you're just so gripped by them that you're like, man, I gotta, you know, who can I tell about this? You know?
Yeah.
You know,
it was like that. Yeah.
So anyway, well, that's a great choice. Like you had told me about while you were reading it, and I knew it was one of your favorites, but you know, it's a great example also of just kind of the diversity, the type of stuff that John reads in particular. But we're up against the clock. So let's move on to the last segment of the show. I think that wraps up our favorite books of the year, doesn't it?
Yeah, we were going to talk about like one book each that like really disappointed us.
Oh yeah.
But I really don't think – I think we'll have to cut that, you know, just for
time. Yeah, I agree. We are going to talk about – every year I do – just to explain, every year I do a dog of the year where I put on, like, the book I just absolutely couldn't stand, you know. And there's usually one per year. Sometimes I can't come up with anything. But this year I had a good one. But it's – you know, it's such a dog, I don't even know if it's even worth talking about. So, like – so, yeah, you know.
Let's wrap it up.
All right. So what are you going to be reading next?
Well, okay. So the next book, I'm finishing this book that I mentioned at the outset, Philosophy of Walking. I kind of don't want it to end because I'm so into it. But I'm going to shift to a book that I first read, you know, maybe 25 years ago when I was a much younger man. And I'm reading this, I might as well say, in anticipation of an episode that we're planning for the near future. Probably not the next one, but we're looking forward at some point to diving into the work of the American novelist Walker Percy, because among other reasons we feel he's kind of fallen out of popular favor in a way, and I think he's in a fascinating writer and someone who is not to be ignored. So his most popular novel by far, I think it won the National Book Award. It was his first novel. It was called The Movie Goer. And so I first read it as a younger man. I'm going to read that again in anticipation of a possible upcoming discussion of the work of Walker Percy.
Right. And that goes all the way back to, like, what, the 60s?
Yeah, the book does. Yeah. And I probably read it, you know, in my late 20s, maybe around age 30. But I remember very little of it. But it's the book. It's definitely the book that put him on the map. So.
Yeah, famous book, even from the 20th century, the moviegoer. So that's going to be cool. And, yeah, I'm looking forward to when we talk about his work because he's somebody that both of us read in our 20s but haven't revisited for a long time. So that's going to be very interesting.
Right.
And for me, I don't know because I can't see that far down the 600 pages I have left in Our Mutual Friend by Charles Dickens. I have an idea of where I want to go next, but – I just feel like anything can happen over the course of 600 pages, John, which is going to take me at least a month, if not longer, to read through all that. So I'm not even really going to say. And all that leaves is, do you mind if I tease the immediate next episode that we have coming up?
No, do it.
Okay, so we've been talking about this, and we've been teasing about this and noodling around it for quite a long time, but we have never done it. We've done episodes on other genres. We have not done a full-length episode, or at least one full-length episode, on the genre of science fiction, ladies and gentlemen. So we are going to talk in episode 65 about some of the really standout science fiction books in our lives. I mean, you know, like our thriller episode, like our horror episode, you know, you could go on all, you know, for 4 episodes or 10 episodes about science fiction or an entire podcast. You know, because there are many people that probably do that. But we haven't talked about our kind of seminal works of science fiction, so that's what we're going to be diving into next time, and it's going to be interesting to see what makes the list for either one of us. You know, in some cases, they're like writers we really admire, but you got to narrow it down to 1 or 2 books from that writer, you know?
Right.
So it's going to be an interesting process of kind of narrowing down what, like, are really our favorite science fiction books, but I can't wait, you know, for a couple of dorks like us. This is a chance to really dork all the way out, and so that's what we're going to do.
Yeah, that's going to be a ton of fun, but it's such a huge topic that there's, you know, there's no way we could even remotely cover it all, but we're just going to share some of our favorites, you know, and they may be ones that listeners are well familiar with, but they may hear about books that they don't know anything about. So that's going to be great diving into that topic.
Yeah, we'll just kind of go back through our list and figure out those ones that really were impactful for, like, Jude and John, because, you know, that's the perspective that you get when you tune into this show. And
amen.
So without further ado, this wraps up episode 64. Another great episode, John. It was really fun to talk to you about the best books of the year from our point of view. Again, email us, bookexchangetwins.com, if you want to share your lists. Let us know what books were your favorites in 2023. And failing that, you know, it's time to say goodnight and so long.
All right, Jude. Great job kind of running this show. And I will talk to you the next time.
All right. Take care, everyone.
Cheers. Okay, Jude, hopefully you can hear me.
Yep, I got you.
Okay. We had some audio problems there, but we seem to be back, so we'll just plow forward. Great list. I've already, you know, offline, you know, complimented you on your list, and I think, you know, we're not going to keep doing that. I'll just read my list, and what I was saying before is that we usually don't have many titles in common. This year, for some reason, we have 3 titles in common between our 2 lists, which that's pretty unusual for us.
So, yeah, it is. Yeah, that's crazy.
So I'll just kind of highlight those. But as you said before, I just come up with a list of 10. I do not rank them, but I will pick out, you know, kind of a number one book of the year for me, which I'll get to that as the last book I mention here. My first choice is The Employees. You already mentioned it, by Olga Raven, or Robin. Hopefully we're saying that, you know, somewhat close to how it's pronounced. We're going to talk about that in a little bit. So I won't describe that for now. My second book is called An Immense World, How Animal Senses Reveal the Hidden Realms Around Us, by Ed Yong. And this is a huge nonfiction book that's just sort of about the fascinating sensory world of animals, kind of what animals take in through their senses. It surveys a whole bunch of new science around that, all kinds of different animals, you know, from the biggest mammals and whales all the way down to the tiniest insects. And it just, it delivers on the title, just kind of opens up this vast world that we really know nothing about as human beings. I thought it was fascinating. Third book is The Mountain and the Sea. You mentioned it, by Ray Naylor, you know, an awesome, you called it Michael Crichton-esque. I think anybody who's read Michael Crichton can get the gist. I mean, that means it's just an action-packed sort of science fiction, not epic, but just page turner. And that book was an absolute blast. The next book is called When Breath Becomes Air. I did talk about this book on our recent episode about memoirs. It's by a doctor named Paul Kalanithi. Sorry about that. And it's just kind of like literally his dying memoir about grappling, you know, about finishing an incredibly arduous, you know, program of study to become a neurosurgeon. And he shares some of his experiences as a neurosurgeon, but then sort of as soon as he finishes the long 10-year trek to become a neurosurgeon, he gets diagnosed with terminal lung cancer. And it's a very moving sort of memoir about his battle with that cancer and about mortality. It's an incredible book. It was very, very moving. The next one is the third one that we have in common. It's a book called The Hunter by Julia Lee. And you already described it. It's a great book coming out of New Zealand. Julia Lee's a writer that I've really heard nothing else about other than this book. I don't know if you have. But as far as I'm concerned, this novel of hers, you know, makes her a memorable writer, you know, pretty much for all time. It's a great book.
Yeah.
The next one is a memoir. I've mentioned it on the show at least once before. Every Man for Himself and God Against All by the great German filmmaker and artist Werner Herzog. It's just, you know, I'll talk about that a little bit more later. It's just an unbelievable look at the life of just a truly, you know, unique artist. I don't always do this, but I try to include at least one, because I read a lot of poetry. I try to include at least one volume of poetry. This year, that comes from Wendell Berry. It's a great slim little volume called The Peace of Wild Things, which is just some of his very moving, very accessible poetry about the land and about the natural earth. And it's just a beautiful collection. Really love that book. The next one is a short story collection called Land of Big Numbers by a woman named Tay Ping Chen. And she is a Chinese-American journalist who, and this is her first work of fiction, and it's a fascinating collection of stories that, you know, some of them are sort of vaguely sci-fi, kind of magical realist, to use that sort of cliche term, but they all take place either in China, most of them take place in China, or involve people who are from China who have emigrated, and it's a fascinating collection and kind of a really interesting look at sort of modern China. And then the next book is called The Tiger, A True Story of Vengeance and Survival by John Valent. You've heard me, you know, expressing effusive praise about that book because I just finished it towards the end of the year. I'll talk about that a little bit more in a second. It's an incredible book of biology and kind of history. It's awesome. And then finally, my favorite book that I read in all of 2023, I mentioned it many times on the podcast across the last year because it took me a long time to read it. That was the Pulitzer Prize winning biography of Frederick Douglass called Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom by a writer named David W. Blight. And it's just an exhaustive and comprehensive and absolutely, I thought it was riveting biography of a very, very important figure, not just in African-American history, but American history and really the world. But he just had an incredible story from his very humble beginnings as a slave to becoming,
you know, a statesman, an orator, and a diplomat for the United States government. Just unbelievable book. There's just insights on every page. So, yeah, that's my list. That was my favorite book from this year. And, you know, there are definitely some different threads that you can discern between my list and yours.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, they're very different flavor, but they're both good and they're both kind of interesting. And it was really interesting for us. We almost never have three titles in common, you know. And then I believe they're all fiction titles because most of mine tend to be fiction. So that's interesting too because, I mean, you heard John has a lot of nonfiction on his list, but, you know, he had healthy sampling of some fiction and genre fiction even. So we're going to get into some of that stuff anyway. But, okay, so we've each kind of hand-picked a selection of books from our list. And, John, that list is awesome. Like, you know, I mean, I knew all that was on the list, but just listening to it again, I was like, man, these books are just nuts. Off the chart, you know. It was really cool. But so we've hand-selected books that stood out to us from our own list. We're going to talk about them, you know, into a little bit more detail kind of for the remainder of the episode here. But before we do that, this is my ad lib, John. I was listening to you talk at the beginning, and I wanted to ask if you would, and then I'll do the same thing, talk just a little bit, not at length, about the process you go through when you actually sit down at the end of the year to sit down and choose your 10 books. Like, how does that work for you?
Yeah, sure. I can answer that pretty briefly. I keep a running tally of everything I read throughout the year. And when I'm finished with a book, so I'm noting every book. And when I'm finished with a book, if I really loved it, or if I just was totally hooked by it, found it riveting, found it fascinating, I'll highlight it in a different color. And to me, that's kind of a signal like that this is a candidate for one of the best books of the year, just because of how fascinating or whatever I thought it was, how it got its hooks in me. And so when I get to the way I read, I tend to, at the end of each year, I've read between, let's say, 50 and 65 books a year. That's my total. And, you know, whatever. Everybody has a different pace. But I usually end up somewhere in there. And so I go through my list towards the very end of the year, and I just simply pick out the ones that I've highlighted. I happen to highlight them in red. And then I have a list of maybe 20 books or whatever. It could be 20, it could be 30, it could be 13. And I just simply go through the list, and as I look at each one, I try, you know, my test is how much does it stand out of my memory, you know, not necessarily details, but, you know, when I see the title, do I think to myself, oh yeah, you know, I remember liking that book, but I don't remember much about it. Or do I say, oh, that book was incredible, or that book really, you know, taught me some things I never knew before, kind of blew me away. And that's how I sort of whittle that list down. And then, you know, I just kind of do a process of whittling to get it down to 10. So that's kind of how I do it. But I end up with the books that really, I try to choose the books that really, really gripped me. And, you know, not only did I have an amazing time reading the book, but, you know, I still think about sometimes. Sometimes it might be a character, or it might be a subject. Or in the case of the Frederick Douglass book, it just had me really thinking about the history of African-American people from the Civil War to the Civil Rights era, you know, and that kind of tragic trajectory. But that's just one example. So it's just whatever really stands out in my mind, those are the ones I tend to pick.
Well, that's really interesting to kind of break that down, because I'm not sure we've actually broken this down. I mean, a little bit between us in conversation, but not like this, because because you and I don't really always approach these kind of things the same way. Yes, we're twins and we think similarly, and sometimes our lists overlap, but this kind of thing is not always the same process, you know? Like, you have some much more analytical ways of doing things than I do them, and vice versa or whatever. But actually, like, the process is remarkably similar up to a certain point. So, you know, I won't be too long, but so I keep a tally also during the year of every book that I read. I simply write down the title, the author, and the month that I finished the book. And then I've been doing that for, I don't know, going on 30 years. Some of the lists I've lost, but like the last, certainly the last 20 years, I have in this little spiral notebook. And then maybe in the last 10 or 12 years, I started to just put, when I finished a book that I thought was a candidate, just like you said, as one of the best books I read during the year, and I think this is somewhere around the time that we maybe started writing our own lists, I put a little check mark by the title. You know, so that tells me that it's a candidate for the book of the year.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And then at the end of the year, like I always do it in December, and you like waiting until the year has turned. And, you know, and you do it early in the following year.
Right.
The only reason I do it in December is that's when all the news outlets tend to do it. So, but then sometimes I get bit in the butt, like a couple years ago when I read the book Barkskins right around Christmas by Annie Proulx at the end of the year. And I said to myself, and then I finished it early in the next year. I said to myself, well, that should have been on my list. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it happens. But anyway, and then what I do is I don't know if this is a difference, but I take my notebook out and I take my regular writing notebook where I compose my writing work, because I always include this in with stuff I'm working on. I don't know why. I just make it part of the record. And I start a new page, and then I write down everything that got the check mark. But for me, I like from that – it's almost like Jesus take the wheel. You know, like I like – from that point on, I like to go on kind of auto – not autopilot, but like pure gut. So I just kind of take a look at the list, and I start scratching off ones that just – my gut tells me just it was good. It's not good enough, you know,
mm-hmm.
or it wasn't good enough. And it's basically based on memory. It's sort of similar to your method, but I don't like to think about it too hard. And I've done this. I went back and I looked at my notebooks where I have like the various, you know, pages where I worked out the list from years past, and that they look almost exactly the same. There's this longer list. There's some titles crossed out. And then what I'll do is I'll do it until I have 10 titles left. And then those are my 10 books. I don't go back and look at the ones I crossed out again.
Hmm.
And then I go down that list, and on the right side where the title ends on the page, I put a little number with a circle around it. And I just start doing it just like quickly. Like I just say, what's my book number, the 10? And I just kind of look at it, and then I'm like, yeah, you know, it's this one. And somehow by doing that, like I – in that process – because I usually do not know what my book of the year is. Almost every year I don't know what my book of the year is. But then when I'm going through this process, there'll be like a book or two that I'm like, no, that can't be number 8. That can't be number 7. It's got to be higher. And then I end up going like, this is my book of the year. Like, this was the best book I read this year. And it's like almost kind of a surprise.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's how I do it. But this year was interesting because this year, almost the whole year after March, I knew what my favorite books were. You know, which were the books by Claire Keegan. I even read them again towards the end of the year because I knew they were the best and I wanted to read them again. That's very rare. So anyway, I just thought it might be interesting to share with readers. You know, if we're going to dork out, we might as well go all the dorking way, John.
Oh, yeah, I agree.
Until all the lists come together. But anyway, so that was fun. It was fun to go through that. I mean, it's like a similar process, but not exactly the same. So.
Well, like you and like you said, like I'm not sure that we've ever actually laid that out for each other in all the years that we've been doing our own personal exchange. And weirdly enough, you said like this. You're still hearing me?
Yeah.
You said this year you had a clear number one, and yours was all the way back in March. Mine didn't go back that far, but I too, like as soon as I, you know, I was plowing through the Frederick Douglass biography basically through the early summer and kind of into the heart of the summer. It took me, it was by far the longest time to read a book this year. And it wasn't because of the length, but it like when I finally finished that book, I thought, well, it does have to do with the length because it was such a long book, but I was riveted through the whole thing. And then when I find it was like a pilgrimage or something, you finally get to the end and you go, well, I'm never going to forget that. You know, that's kind of how I felt about this book. And I felt at the time like I would be really surprised if any book that I read is going to be as satisfying as that one. And I read a lot of great books, but nothing was as as satisfying, you know, as that book. And it sort of stuck out to me in the middle of the year too. And it just simply never, you know, got knocked off the throne, so to speak. So,
yeah. And it's funny, this year there was not only was there not much suspense on my list, but there was not much suspense on your list, you know, because right. you were, you know, in a way, although it still turned out to have plenty of surprises, but it, you know, I knew, let's put it this way. At halfway point of the year, I knew what my best book was going to be, and I knew what your best book was going to be, and that never happens. But like when you and I got together once, to, you know, over the summer for a couple of days, and you were reading the Frederick Douglass book, and we were talking about it at that time, and it was like earlier on in the summer, and I remember thinking to myself, well, every time John talks about this book, he says every page has stuff I learn a ton about. And I know you, and I know you like learning. I thought, well, there's no suspense this year, you know, like, but I was glad because I'm the one who gave you the book, you know, so I was like, you know, go me, score one for me.
That's right. You know,
but well, yeah, but when, you know, when it's a book like that and you're just kind of like lapping up every page, I mean, it doesn't matter how long it takes you. You were kind of in your happy place in a way.
Yeah. And I'll just say one more thing about that book and then we can move on. And I have a suggestion, kind of a formatting suggestion for what we can do next, right. But I'll have you know that yes, you gave me that book. I loved it so much. I shared it with my 91-year-old Swiss mother-in-law, who wow. And I mentioned Swiss because she's not even, well, she's an American citizen, but she wasn't born here. But she's fascinated with American history. I bought her the book, and she's still a vigorous reader at 91. God bless her.
That's amazing.
And she's reading it now. And she loves it. I mean, she is just riveted by this book. So, like, so whether you're a 50-something-year-old, you know, American white male, or you're a 91-year-old woman from Switzerland, I mean, it's just an incredible book. So, I thought you would that would be gratifying for you to hear that because she loves the book. So,
and not only that, I know we're talking about this book at length, but then again, it is your favorite book of the year, so it kind of fits with that. But anyway, I didn't really, if you remember, this was kind of an accident. I didn't really do it on purpose. I can't say that I did, but I got, when I bought the book for you, I got an extra copy of the book myself, and I have the book, and I'm definitely going to read the book. I haven't read the book yet, so I have the book kind of sitting here.
Forgot that. For you know,
yeah.
Maybe I've hyped it so much that you're going to be like, this thing sucked. But
no,
I kind of doubt it.
Those big biographies are just amazing, you know.
Well, and his story and what he lived through, all that he lived through, is just astounding. But anyway, what I would suggest, dude, because I know, so we're gonna talk about. I'm kind of taking over a little bit here, but I think you'll agree. We're gonna talk about a couple different, you know, titles from each of our lists, but we have one in common. Why don't we hit that one in common and then take a quick break and then come back and we can each discuss, you know, the other three that we wanted to highlight.
Well, that they don't call us twins for nothing, folks, because I was going to suggest that also, basically.
Okay. Cool.
I mean, my first book, I was going to let you go first, but my first book was going to be, I believe you're talking about The Employees, right?
I am, yeah.
Yeah, my book is first book was going to be that. I was going to say, John, let's just dive in to the one we have in common. So are you ready?
Yeah. Do you want me to kick it off?
I don't know. Like, I was going to kick it to you so you could start it off. We don't need to go on a great length about any of them.
No.
But, yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so we've already mentioned that this is a very slim, I guess you'd call it science fiction, but it's a lot. It's a lot more than that, and it's a lot stranger than that in a way. I wasn't familiar with this Dutch writer at all. She may have written other books. I don't think very many, but this seems to be the book that has really grabbed attention, at least internationally. Maybe she's well known, you know.
Well, speaking of internationally, we don't want to offend anybody. She's not Dutch. She's Danish.
Yeah, I wondered about that actually. But anyway, so. Apologies to Olga Robin. She actually has a new book out this year that I've seen on some year-end lists. I'm sure you've probably heard about that too, Jude, have you?
I think at the time, because I didn't know who she was, I looked up and I know there was another one, but I don't remember what it was called.
Oh, it's like what fascinates me is, and we're going to talk about the employees in just a minute, but her latest book is called The Work. I believe that's what it's called. And it's about basically a new mother who gives birth to a baby, and she's like a working mother, and she's sort of trying to, I'm sure it's a lot stranger based on having read The Employees, but she's sort of trying to navigate being a mother of a newborn and kind of going on with her life. And so it's sounds completely different than The Employees. And I just thought that was fascinating, but that's gotten a lot of great attention over the past year too. So that's pretty interesting. But man,
wow.
The Employees is going to be hard to summarize this because I will say to the listeners, like I read this in January of 2023 and it has stayed with me throughout the entire year. But that means my memory of it, of the details, is going to be fuzzy. And this is a very strange book, and it's a slim volume. I've got it right in front of me. I think it's like 120 pages. Yeah, 122 pages. So it's not long at all. And the setup is there has been a ship that has left the planet Earth to investigate another planet. And I'm just, gosh, my memory is fuzzy already. So the ship
is so far.
The ship is called the 6000 ship, and I can't even remember why that is now.
Well, I don't either.
No, I think it's because there's 6000 people on it. And it is being sent by some corporation. We don't get the name of it. And they've been sent to, there's another planet that has been found that has life on it. They've been sent to explore the planet. But they're under the guidance and auspices of a corporation. And so something has happened on the ship en route to the planet. We know that they made it to the planet. We know that they collected certain specimens, or what the book calls objects, from the surface of the planet. So they've done some planetary exploration. But there are incidents that have happened on the ship, either on the way or, you know, since the ship has been gone from the Earth, and they involve, the ship includes, you come to learn that the ship includes both humans and humanoids or robots that are part of the crew or the passengers of the ship. And there's been some kind of an incident that looks like a kind of uprising by the employees of the corporation on board the ship. Trying to take the ship over, trying to protest against the corporation. And the book itself is an investigation of what happened on the ship. And right. So the format of the book is you're told in the beginning that the corporation is interviewing people who are on the ship. And so the format of the book is just brief, you know, 1 to 2 page transcripts of what various passengers on the ship have to say about what happened or about their experience. And that's all you get. So you get this series of, and each, you know, kind of entry is labeled statement 89 or statement 66, and they're not in numerical order. So it's kind of this weird mosaic. You read it and you're trying to piece together, okay, what's going on this ship? Who's on the ship? What happened that's being investigated? She doesn't spell any of that out for you in the beginning. And oh, by the way, you know, they've collected these specimens, or again, as the book calls them, objects, brought them back on board the ship. And those objects are having a strange effect on the people or the, you know, passengers on the ship. So you're also kind of piecing that together as well. And so like the whole book, that's all the book is. It's almost like a legal transcript in a way, or transcript of interviews where you're trying to piece together what's going on. And that sort of comprises the entire book. But along the way, it's a fascinating premise, but you're also getting, you know, you're you're getting a lot of different multiple perspectives on what's going on what these objects are, on, you know, the relationships between the humans and the androids or robots. And, you know, your mind and imagination goes in a thousand different directions trying to piece together what's going on. So that's what the book is about. I mean, do I have that basically right from what you remember, or did I miss anything crucial?
Well, I read it not too long after you sent it to me kind of almost immediately. You're like, you got to check this out. And yeah, my experience was similar. I also don't remember much of the details. I remember probably nothing beyond what you've already described. Except I think the way I saw it, maybe we're saying the same thing, maybe we're not, was that, you know, ship goes out there. They're supposed to investigate this planet. They get all these specimens or objects from the planet, bring them onto the ship, and that's what causes all of the events that follow, including like the insurrection type behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's something about going out there, you know, it has this mission, this corporate sponsored mission. They bring these objects in. I can't even remember if they really describe them or not.
They do, but it's very cryptic and weird. Very.
Yeah.
Weird.
It's like hard to understand even what they are.
You can't tell if they're organic or non-organic.
Right, like yeah. A plant or a weird, like, you know, like monolith, like in 2001.
Right.
You get these things on the ship, and it's like you said, that these whatever these alien things are, they start affecting the people on the ship, you know. And one of the things – can I go on about it or
– Yeah, please.
One of the things that I love about it – and this has nothing to do with the book itself, but it's just this is the marketing, but it's just the way that this book is written so that – it's this – the version John and I have, this American version John and I have just like – it's like a really small paperback version that's like you can almost fit in your pocket. And on the front of it, there's this like standard office water cooler, you know?
Right.
Like if you look it up on Amazon, this is what you'll see. And instead it's like – instead of having filled with water, it's like leaking out this black, you know, tar-looking liquid. And that's the whole image. That's all you get. And, you know, that it makes it – and I love that. I thought that was worth mentioning because that gives you – that's a great visual of kind of what you're going to get in this book. It's this kind – it's sort of a corporate thing. It's a little, you know, like a, you know, a tiny dash of like even an office space or something like that. But you're out in space, but there's this corporate element to it. And that to me is like – is mimicked by the type of the way all the information is presented, because it struck me that you're basically getting a file. What you have is a file,
right?
You know, right. From this investigation, and you open the manila file back in the day or whatever, and you get these, you know, these sequenced statements from these people or maybe not people. And to me, I don't even remember. I could not describe the events that, you know, which character did what, or, you know, who sabotaged what or anything like that. Or I have no idea how the book ends, you know, like,
yeah.
But to me, the fascination of this book and the way I would try to sell it is that it's just, it's so like unique and strange, and it's vaguely sinister, but it's disorienting. But just the impressive thing to me was how this was all done, in not only this unique conceit of like almost a file, like a file with these statements, but like each statement gives you very little information, you know? Like some of them are like two or three sentences, and rarely does it go over one page. But you're getting, you know, enough information to make you kind of freaked out, scared, confused. You're kind of laughing at the whole, like the vague kind of like corporate satire or send up of the corporate world. It's an amazing performance, if you ask me.
Oh yeah, it's such a weird book. It really is very, very hard to describe. And I think anybody who's like a science fiction fan, like especially science fiction movies, like you, this book is kind of a weird mix of like you said, it's like an office satire, like Office Space, or The Office Program, even, but not that comedic. Or there was a recent show called Severance on Apple TV that was a darker office satire. This reminded me like that of that a little bit. Mm-hmm. But then combined with stuff like, you know, 2001, where, you know, the ship, you don't, there are non-human elements that you're not sure of what their motives are. And there's a communication between the ship and like the home base back on planet Earth. There's also Solaris, where another famous science fiction movie where the interaction between something on the planet and the people on the ship is causing, you know, all kinds of strange psychological episodes, you know. So,
yeah.
So if you've seen any of these movies, you get some sense of kind of the mood of this book, but it's also, like you said, kind of mixed with this like legal investigation, kind of like this transcript style. And all this is to say, like, I've thought about this book so much. It has this just very odd, weird, dreamlike quality to it. But I think ultimately, and this is fascinating to me, and then we can move on after this, but like, I think it's just, she's writing a book, kind of a book about work and working for like a large corporation. But mm-hmm. she decided to frame it with this bizarre science fiction premise. But really, you know, whether the people on the ship are human or not, they all seem to be kind of resisting, you know, the orders or the rules of the corporation that's governing the whole thing. And you just get this vague sense as you're reading through it that they're getting more and more restless. And finally, you know, you kind of piece together that there's something that happened, some kind of like uprising might be too strong of a word, but just like, you know, we're not going to follow the rules anymore. And I do remember at the very end, I'm pretty sure at the very end of the book, spoiler alert here, like, you know, don't listen for the next 15 seconds if you don't want to know. But I think the corporation basically chooses to like destroy the ship.
So okay. It's
like basically, I don't know, blows it up or whatever.
Yeah.
And because there is a little addendum at the end of the book that says that's kind of written, I believe, from the point of view of like, I think it might be a last transmission from the ship or something like that. But anyway, we can kind of leave it there. But it's just, I've never read anything like it. You know, like it is one of the most original books I've ever read. And I'm still kind of puzzling over it. And to me, that's unbelievably interesting that this woman from Denmark, you know, wrote this book that is just, it's like a Rubik's Cube within a, wrapped up in Enigma. It's just an unbelievable puzzle, but incredibly imaginative, but incredibly weird. You have to be a certain kind of reader to even crack this thing.
Yeah, totally. I said at the end of my write-up that, the reader's going to puzzle over it, but they won't forget it, you know?
That's right.
That's kind of how I feel about the book, too.
Yeah. And I said, when I was writing about it, I said, you know, I'm not even sure how to describe the book. Is it science fiction, corporate satire, meditation on memory and trauma, eerie prophecy of technology run amok? Well, all the above could apply, you know?
Right.
It kind of resists categorization, so... You know, you're either the kind of the reader that is going to say, man, I need to read that. Or you're going to say, like, someone like my wife.
Next.
My wife would read about five words of this book and be like, you know, that would be it. Chuck it out. So
if you're into anything where the WTF factor is like through the roof, you know, this book is for you. You know,
that's right.
But anyway, should we take a break or should we keep going?
No, let's take a quick break and then we'll come back and then let's, you know, dive into the individual books that we both want to kind of quickly highlight.
All right. Sounds good.
All right.